Welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Harry Murray, and he'll be answering your most important questions on fly fishing streams for smallmouth bass. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Harry a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure to sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and email address on the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within 24 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website, your convenience, listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Harry Murray about fly fishing streams for smallmouth bass. The Federation of Fly Fishers needs your support. Its conservation projects at both the national and club level are addressing critical issues of importance to fly fishers. It is involved in the Mangrove Recovery Initiative in Florida, in the Trout of the Desert Southwest Initiative to help the recovery of rare native trout, the Endangered Fisheries Initiative, and is helping to prevent the introduction of harmful aquatic species to the new waters with their Clean Angling Pledge. The Federation won a National Conservation Award for its effort. To continue this great work on behalf of all fly fishers, the Federation needs to increase its membership. It needs more concerned anglers willing to join in support of such projects, and by doing so, give something back to the sport that has given so much to each of us. Join the Federation of Fly Fishers today and help support their fine work. And if you're already a member, go ahead and send them a donation. For more information, go to the Federation website at www.fedflyfishers.org. That's www.fedflyfishers.org. Before we introduce Harry, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away for our drawing. Tonight we'll be giving away a 3-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a 1-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine. So you have two chances to win in our drawing. Now if you haven't registered for the drawing yet, go to our homepage now at askaboutflyfishing.com and look for the link under Harry's section that says click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link, fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners of the drawing at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a copy of Harry's book, Fly Fishing Techniques for Smallmouth Bass, courtesy of Amato Books. Here's how you can win that book. You must be the first person to answer the question at the end of the show. And the question is going to be about something that Harry and I talk about during the show. You must submit your answer along with your name and location in the text box on our homepage. So listen closely and use your best typing skills, and hopefully you'll win that book. Our guest tonight is Harry Murray. Harry Murray was born, raised, and still lives on the North Fork of the Shenandoah River in the village of Edinburgh, Virginia, where he owns and has operated Murray's Fly Shop for over 40 years. Drawing from a lifetime of smallmouth bass fishing, guiding, and teaching at his angling schools, he has developed his own approach to evaluating rivers and streams in order to find the best places to fish. Harry can discuss in great depths the various minnows found in the smallmouth rivers, the flies that match them, and the most productive techniques for fishing them. The smallmouth nymphing game is one of Harry's favorite techniques, and it shows when he takes you on the river and helps you discover the types of water and methods that work best. He also loves taking smallmouth on dry flies and surface bugs. Harry has published 8 books on fly fishing and has also made 2 videos and 2 DVDs. His articles can be seen regularly in many national fly fishing magazines. Harry conducts on-the-stream fly fishing schools each spring and summer out of his fly shop for trout and smallmouth bass. And in the winter, he conducts classes on fly fishing and fly tying in Murray's Fly Shop. He has designed over 50 fly patterns for both trout and bass and provides guide service for both in the Virginia area. Harry, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Roger, it's a pleasure to be with you. I'm looking forward very much to this.
Well, good. It's great to have you, and I hear you're fresh off the river of fishing today, your day off on Wednesday, and what better way to finish off the day but talk about some more fishing, right?
That sounds very exciting.
Okay, good. Well, folks, we're going to talk about smallmouth bass, specifically in stream fishing for smallmouth. I know there might have been one or two questions on reservoirs and so forth, but we're going to pretty much stick to the stream fishing, and that's where Harry has done quite a bit of work and research and has a lot of practical experience. So let's dig right in. We're going to talk about the fish, the flies, the equipment, the strategies and tactics, and try to pick Harry's brain as much as we can here. So, Harry, you know, you fish for smallmouth for many years. Can you give us a little bit of background about the origins of the fish, the history, the habitat, and so forth?
Well, Roger, I grew up with a smallmouth stream just one block from my home, which actually was one of the main feeders into the North Fork of the Shenandoah River. That little stream is Stony Creek, which still goes through Edinburgh and has a pretty good smallmouth population. The origin of the smallmouth in my particular area actually came upstream from the Potomac River. These were transferred from Wheeling Creek over in West Virginia in an old railroad car tender, and they were dumped into the CNO Canal and gradually worked their way up into both the North and the South Fork of the Shenandoah River. And they really have adapted well. They do well in these streams. Their habits are very much like rainbow trout in some of the streams. Their feeding mannerism is quite similar to some of the brown trout that I fish for in the streams out in Montana.
Well, great. What if you were to describe the nature of personality of a smallmouth bass compared to trout? How would you describe them?
Well, I'd call the smallmouth the gentleman of the warm water species. He feeds in little different areas in a little different manner than the largemouth bass, feeding quite similar to the browns, as the browns in the Yellowstone will lie back under the banks and feed on hoppers and things drifting along, so will the smallmouth bass. He'll overlap in the way he'll feed on the Helgemite larva, the Dobson fly larva. He feeds on those in the riffles the same way the browns and the rainbows would over in the Yellowstone River, feeding in those big stonefly nymphs. So there is a lot of overlap in the way we see the smallmouth bass in the streams we fish here and the tactics and flies we use in a lot of the larger streams in the Rockies.
Do you think that a smallmouth is more aggressive or, you know, a hungrier kind of fish than, say, a brown trout? I mean, are they on the fly?
Quite similar. Actually, many years ago, I was developing some nymphs to use primarily out west, big stonefly nymphs. Charlie Brooks there in West Yellowstone was a very good personal friend. And I sent some of these out to Charlie to play with that summer before I got out in the fall. And I must have made a little apology there, saying that the only thing I had to test these flies on here in Virginia were the smallmouth bass. And back came a very smoking letter from Brooks, just chewing me up one side and down the other for saying that my smallmouth weren't as smart as his trout were, because apparently Charlie had quite a respect for the smallmouth bass just as well.
Yeah. Well, now, we've got a question from Greg Robinson in Michigan. And he asks, are spotted bass the same as rock bass? And the spotted bass being another name for the smallmouth, right?
Well, it depends on who you're talking about.
Okay.
In this area, the spotted bass could be called a smallmouth bass. We seldom do that. Now, what we call the rock bass in this area, it's got three different names, rock bass, goggle eye, or red eye. But that's an entirely different fish, feeding in a little bit slower water than what we would normally find the smallmouth bass. The smallmouth bass in the mid-Atlantic drainage is going to be in the fastest drainage. The little bit slower water over to the side would be the rock bass or the goggle eyes, we locally call them, and then over in the slowest water of all, you'd find your sunfish. So if you're out there just fishing along and catching nothing but sunfish, you're fishing water that's entirely too slow.
Too slow, yeah. Now, do you get any crossover of brown trout and smallmouth in the rivers?
Not in the area that I'm fishing here in the Shenandoah drainage. The Shenandoah is just a little bit too warm for smallmouth, for browns. The Game Commission stocks some browns, and they do wash down in the streams, but normally we don't have brown trout in the Shenandoah drainage.
Now, I don't know if you have the same activity in the Shenandoah drainage, but Dave Hucko in Rochester, New York, he says he lives there in Lake Ontario, and he wants to know when bass come into the tributaries to spawn and when do they leave. Do you have that kind of activity?
Yeah, we get that. Usually spawning in my area, which is just about 200 miles directly west of Washington, D.C., right in the middle of the Shenandoah Valley. This area, we find the smallmouth spawning at around 50 degrees, and that normally is in middle April to the middle of May. Now, this year, for example, we had a lot of water at that time, and it pushed them back a little bit. They just sort of held off till things calmed down a little bit. But normally we'll have the smallmouth spawning in the Shenandoah drainage and the feeders that come into them. But they, most of them don't actually leave the main river to find a cooler place to spawn. They're perfectly happy spawning in the rivers themselves.
Okay, okay. Now, what about coming out of lakes or reservoirs? Is that...
We have... The closest thing we have in this particular area to that would be the dams that were built here 50 to 80 years ago, small hydro dams. And when I say small, I mean dams that are 20 feet high. Only a few of them used to generate electricity now. Now, those bass will move on up into the headwaters to spawn and in some cases to do the major part of their feeding. But lakes per se, I don't have in my area.
Okay, okay. Where in the world can we find smallmouth? Are they primarily located in North America, or do you find them elsewhere in the world?
Yeah, you got me on that one, Roger. I don't know.
Okay.
I really am not sure.
But we know they're prevalent throughout the North America, throughout the U.S. So.
Well, I get a lot of emails and customers in, and we sell a lot of flies to people up and down the East Coast, primarily from North Carolina, on up into Canada, New York, Canada, on up and down the East Coast, and out in the Minnesota, Wisconsin area. Now, I used to write for one of the magazines down in North Carolina, an excellent magazine, state magazine, and the editor always said, well, now send me trout stories because my smallmouth fishing isn't all that great in North Carolina. So most of the action I see is from here north.
Yeah, yeah. Now, is there, we do have a question from Hugo in Ames, Iowa, wondering if there's any good smallmouth rivers in Iowa. And I know you may not fish that, but is there any kind of a resource available to find
it? I'm not sure, Roger. He should check with Fish and Game on that.
Yeah, no, that's a good idea. Yeah, just check with Iowa Fish and Game and see where they've got them out there. Yeah. We just got a question in on the Internet, and I know we had one come in prior to the show. Jim Mosser in West Virginia, and then Joe in Northfield, New Jersey. They're both asking about, I guess there was a smallmouth fish kill or something in the Shenandoah River system around?
Yes. 3-4 years ago, we had a problem. The biologists still have not fully resolved the cause of it, but it's coming back. Last year, for instance, I caught more large smallmouth bass last year than I had in the previous 10 years combined. So I'm well pleased the way it's coming back. And this year, I've taken some very big bass. I've taken probably the biggest bass I've had in 10 years I've taken this summer on fly fishing tackle now.
Yeah. Now, is that something that you said they don't know what caused it? And is it the first time it's ever happened for you? Or?
To my knowledge, yes. And this may slip back as much as, it might go back 10 years, but we didn't see much of it. They're trying to put it on agricultural drainage, but there just may be a combination of factors. The biologists feel they have identified a particular bacteria that's causing some of the problems. The problem is that the bacteria is normally found primarily in cold water, so they can't really explain why it would have been in the Shenandoah drainage. And here in the Virginia area, we're also getting some problems now in the James River with that. And in West Virginia, they're getting problems in the drainages they have in their smallmouth streams there. So I'm not sure that the fish kill, as everybody wanted to label it, was, and I'm not sure it had a common denominator. It could have been a combination of things. But we saw very, very few dead fish. We did see some things coming in the newspaper maybe 5 years ago that somebody said, oh, I saw 50 dead fish. Well, this year, Roger, I've seen one dead fish, and, you know, that's normal.
You see that anyway, yeah.
Yeah, you see that anyway.
Yeah. Okay, well, I just wanted to they were curious and hopeful, I think, that everything was coming back and looking good, so it sounds like...
Well, the one thing that the biologist that's, we have in Virginia, a young boy named Larry Moan, is sharp as a tack on this, and Larry thinks one thing that's helped us so much in the last several years is the fact that we've had good water levels in the spring. When the bass could become stressed from whatever the biological factor might have been, in the spawning that goes on in the spring, if there's low water, he felt that there could be some stress there. But for the last several years, we've had excellent spring water level, and I really do think that's what's brought on this good smallmouth fishing we're getting right now.
Yeah, yeah. Now, let's move on to talk more about flies itself. And before that, I always like to ask, well, you know, to determine what flies are going to use, what do smallmouth eat? What are their primary food sources?
Well, they'll eat almost anything that comes in front of them. Actually, that's the way we teach our schools. We sort of stress the natural food in the stream and talk about selecting fly patterns that match those particular natural foods, be it a helgramite, crayfish, sculpin, minna, whatever it may be, damselfly, dragonfly, anything. We try to use fly patterns that match the natural foods and then fish them the way the natural foods would behave. For instance, a helgramite, we'd fish that upstream dead drift in the riffle where the larva, the Dobson fly, is found. And that's the same game you play out on the Yellowstone River with the Bitch Creek nymph.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, we've got a bunch of different questions, and they're kind of random, but we'll kind of work through this thing. First question coming up is Bob Garman in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Bob submitted quite a few questions, which we really appreciate. He said, have you had any success using tandem rigs for smallies, and if so, which flies work in a tandem rig?
We use that quite a bit in our float trips with our clients. If we have a beginning angler, we use a high drift boat for a lot of our float trips. And if he's a little slow on the strike on underwater patterns, a lot of times we'll run a dropper off the tail end of a popper, and automatically he starts catching a whole lot more fish. So that's the old hopper-dropper type thing that's popular throughout the Rockies. And in some cases, we do run a smaller pattern underwater behind a larger underwater pattern. We might be fishing a med tom on the top fly, and as the tail fly, we might go back there with a smaller size, maybe a size 8 streamer or something like that. But the popper and the dropper is a very effective technique.
Okay, good. Never thought about a popper. I guess, you know, out here in the West, we're so used to fishing for trout that, you know, we don't think about poppers too much. But, yeah, that's a great tip. Well, Harry, we need to take a quick break here. But when we come back, we'll talk with you more about fly fishing streams for smallmouth bass. The Platte River Fly Shop in Casper, Wyoming, features a first-class website covering all aspects of fly fishing tailwaters of the North Platte River, including up-to-date local fishing reports, fly patterns, guide services, and online shopping for top-of-the-line gear for any travel destination. The Platte River Fly Shop provides a professional guide staff for the Blue Ribbon Trophy, Gray Reef, and Miracle Mile sections of the North Platte River. Visit their extensive website at www.wyotrout.com. That's wyotrout.com. Or call them at 1-307-237-5997. Again, that's 1-307-237-5997. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Harry Murray about fly fishing streams for smallmouth bass. If you'd like to ask Harry a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible in the show tonight. Well, Harry, before we get back into the fly situation here, I wanted to ask you about, you know, what's happening with you in the fly fishing world. Tell us about your business there and how you're contributing.
Well, Roger, our shop is right in the middle of the Shenandoah Valley. It's Murray's Fly Shop. We have a very active website at www.murraysflyshop.com. And if they have any questions, they can email me at info@murraysflyshop.com, or they can just call me directly at 540-984-4212. One thing we do that helps a lot of visiting anglers is every Friday I put a stream report on our website showing where the fishing's good, what areas are good, what patterns are good, what the water level's like, and that type thing. So many people find that's beneficial, and something we started doing probably about 10 to 15 weeks ago, I'm going on there with about a 10 to 15 minute podcast each week where I'm describing the techniques that we're using at that time. For instance, I just finished talking about the conditions we're using in the low water times we have now. And those podcasts will actually remain on our website, and they can refer back to that in the winter. And when it's too cold to go fishing, they can listen back and hear what I had to say about it.
Well, great, great. That's a great great tool, learning tool for folks. Now, you also teach classes, though, too.
Yes, we have approximately 20 classes throughout the year. We do a block, we do our spring trout schools, but this is a bass show. So during the summer, starting in late May and going on into July and August, we do our smallmouth schools on the stream. We meet in the fly shop. We do a slideshow showing them how to fish nymph streamers, topwater, show them how to do the knots, take them to the stream, and then we start the class in the morning at 9 o'clock in the fly shop, and after we finish there, then we go to the stream and fish until 5 o'clock each evening, and we provide the rod, reel, and everything, and teach them to cast if they need that. If they wanted, one boy said, all I want to do is learn to fish poppers. So for 2 days, I taught that kid everything I could think of on poppers. So we gear that to the individual. Some people have never even picked up a fly rod, and some of the folks in our school, we had one boy fly down from Toronto, got lost in the traffic down at Dulles Airport, ended up in a posted area, and they retain him for several hours, but anyway, he came down, and he'd been fly fishing for 20 or 30 years, and he just wanted to brush up on some fine points. So we do that through the summer, and then during the winter, I do schools in the fly shop every Saturday, talking about how to fish nymphs or how to fish dries, or in some cases, we're tying flies, and all that would be on our website and the dates that we do those through the winter.
Great. Well, why don't you give us your website address one more time?
The website is www.murrays, that's M-U-R-R-A-Y-S, flyshop.com.
Good, good. And we've also got a link to your website on our speakers page for you. So if people didn't catch it, they can go to your Harry's speaker page, and you'll see the link to his website there. So, good. Well, it sounds like you're keeping busy out there, Harry.
Oh, yeah. It's a busy game.
Yeah, I guess, yeah. Now, okay, let's get back into some of these fly questions. We got Robert, North Carolina, wants to know if you've ever used spoon flies for smallmouth.
We use them some. We just haven't really done as much with them as we have some of the other patterns, because I really do try to match the natural food in where I'm fishing. Now, the spoon flies work fine in many areas, but for instance, the last several evenings, I've been fishing the tails of the fools. These bass are dropping back and feeding on a lot of things on the surface, so I'm dropping back and fishing the tails of the pools. We just had a big storm come through, and the riffles were really rolling along, so I went into the riffles and were fishing there with mad toms and sculpins and that type pattern. So rather than the generic type thing like a spoon, we usually try to match the flies that are effective in that particular area.
Matching the hatch, so to speak.
Yeah, match the hatch. In fact, it might have been Charlie Waterman, who, not like having a writer, is a good friend, but I think Waterman reviewed one thing I wrote, maybe introduction to the book, said, what Harry's doing, Harry's really trout fishing for bass. Well, I never thought about it that way, but that's pretty close to what we're doing.
Well, and then that's really what fishing is all about in general. I mean,
that's right. We're matching the hatch. Our Hexagenia hatch has started right now, and boy, that is fun.
Oh, yeah? Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Big flies, right?
Big fly. We use a Mr. Rapidan skater and big Hexagenia that's 2 inches long, and away we go.
Oh, good, good. That sounds like fun. We've got a question from Bob Garman again in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. He says, some of the streams he fished, there's an abundance of damselflies. And he says he's seen the fish come out of the water for these adults. What's a good fly to use in these situations?
what's happening there, and he is very observant to catch that, because many people don't realize what's happening. They see bass jumping, and what are those crazy bass doing? Well, actually, I play a game with them. I didn't realize until about 10 years ago just what he had hit on. Those bass are actually coming up and grabbing those damselflies over the surface. So at this time of the year, with exception of the hexagenia, which is on real late in the evening, if you look down the river and you see a bass airborne, he's coming up and trying to catch them. So I play a game with him. The very instant I see a bass in the air, I look quickly and see if a damselfly flew away. And just in my own mind count, I think they catch about a third of them. Now, what do we do? How do we catch that bass? Since he is not feeding on the surface, see, if he were feeding on the surface, he'd be sucking it under just like a brown trout would. But he's not feeding on the surface. He's feeding, just as he pointed out, above the surface. Well, that's where I got into the skater thing. I had started with Paul Young's Redhead, you know, the old rod builder from Michigan that was so outstanding. Well, he was just as good a fly tire as he was a rod builder. So Bob had a pattern called the Redhead. It was just a greatly overhackled size 8 dry fly. Well, one evening when I finally realized what our friend just mentioned, I put that on and started skating it. I was casting down and across where I'd seen these bass leaping in the air. And I'd cast down and across, greasing that Paul Young's Redhead real heavily with floatant and greasing the leader and skating it around, stiff arm. I'm sitting here with my arm up in the air at a 45-degree angle, and I'm dancing that thing along, trying to make it act like it's really a fly dancing across the surface. Well, they just went crazy for it. So since then, I've developed the damselfly skater, dragonfly skater, and then our best of all is the Mr. Rapidan skater. And these are size 8, 9672. It's a long 3X long shank hook, but greatly overhackled. And all we're trying to do is just dance that thing around like a real damselfly, just scooting across the surface of the water. It's a very effective technique. I have beginners in the class that have read something I've written on it, and they say, oh, Harry, show me how to do that. And take them in below a riffle, and oh, they're just having a ball doing this. So he's right. That's what they're doing. And you're really trying to mimic that flying insect rather than something drifting on the water like a kicking grasshopper.
Yeah. That's interesting, because when Bob asked the question, I had this question mark in my head going, oh, come on, are they really coming out of the water for these damsels, you know? And I'll be darned if that's not what's going on. That's pretty darn interesting.
Murray's brain count says they catch a third up.
Yeah. That's pretty good for them, I'd say. Well, good. Now, those flies you'd mentioned, those are your designs, so I assume you have them on your website.
Oh, yeah, they're just some of ours. They're just greatly overhackled long shank flies that float well, and we can dance them around. We use pretty good grade hackle on them to keep them floating well.
Yeah, okay. Well, Bob has another question. He says he loves catching smallies on the top water. What do you consider to be a good way to catch them below the surface? Type of fly, presentation, location, and streams? That's kind of very general, but
that's a good question, and actually he's right on track with it. See, having grown up in Edinburgh, I thought all kids seine the river for a while. Of course, you know, when you're 12, 8, 9, 10 years old, you're fishing bait. So I thought all kids seine the river and knew where spring minnows were, where sculpins were, where mad toms were, and where helgramites were, and I just assumed that's something everybody knew. So to go under when I'm in those riffles, I remember as a kid, that's where I caught the helgramite. In the big cobblestones at the tails of the pool, we'd go out at night and seine. You'd get a hold of one side of the seine, and I'd get a hold of the other side, and we'd stumble around in the dark in the tails of these pools in water hip deep over a cobblestone bottom, and we'd catch mad tom. Now, that thing looks like a little baby catfish, and they come out at night to feed on small minnows and insects, but in the evening you can usually catch dozens and dozens of the natural mad toms. So then when I get on the river and when I'm fishing that part of the river, I go to the Murray's mad tom and fish it down and across in regular streamer technique. In fact, that was one of the podcasts I did. I had one of my girls that works for me, a pretty good artist. We drew the pool and then showed how to fish these the various streamers in various parts of the pool. And that's still on my website, and all those are under the particular title.
Okay.
But that's a very good question.
So you're saying then that we need to know what part of the river we're talking about to determine what to fish below the surface. Riffles, tailouts, riffles, and so forth.
Well, see, there really isn't. Minnow-wise, in the smallmouth world, we've got two bottom-hugging minnows. We've got the sculpin, which locally we call springman. I didn't know what sculpin was until I started fishing out west. Locally, the sculpin is called a spring minnow. So we've got that, and we've got the mad tom. So those are our two bottom-hugging minnows. Then we have chub minnows that look like small tarpon. And now there's the creek chub, not the horn chub. Everybody looks in the various books and they come up with a horn chub. That's a different animal altogether. But we have the chubs, and then we have the shiner minnows. So those are our minnows, and it's really not that tough to come up with a pattern to match them. I've got a lot of flies that we use to match that, and Bob Clouser's got some excellent patterns that match those. So we're trying to match the natural minnows. Then nymph-wise, the helgramite with a four-year cycle is a tremendous, three-year cycle on the helgramite, the larva of the Dobson fly. And in the right situation, that rascal will get up to 4 to 5 inches long. So they're always in the stream, and they live in the cobblestone bottoms, usually under the riffles. So it's really not that tough to match the natural food in the smallmouth drainages. They're not going to go out there and feed on a size 20 betas nymph like a brown trout would on the Spring Creek. They're going to go for a mouthful.
Okay, okay. Well, that brings a question that came in on the Internet talking about nymphs. George Hancock in Houston, he wants to know, do smallmouth respond to mayfly?
They will when it's heavy enough. Like I say, the hexagenia has just started right now. Now, that's the boys up in the Midwest know the hexagenia well. Well, in the trout streams. That we match very well with Dave Whitlock's red squirrel nymph. That's an excellent match on that. And then the white fly, the Epheron leucaron, which is real active on some trout streams, we get that on some smallmouth streams. And again, that same pattern, a hare's ear nymph in about a size 10, something like that, would work real well on that. In the spring, we get, well, actually, there are four different flies that hatch here in the mid-Atlantic area, and mostly throughout the month of May. And these are generally referred to as brown drakes. And you can go in with a March brown nymph size 12 and do real well on those flies. We also get a lot of caddis, and we match that. I've developed a couple caddis patterns, and there are a lot of good caddis patterns out there. And we get real good caddis hatches, very, very thick caddis hatches, the latter part of May. About 1 mile from where I'm sitting as we're doing this interview on the North Fork of the Shenandoah, I was fishing real late in the evening, and when I got out of the stream, I noticed this gelatinous mass on the front of my waders, and I thought some kind of contamination was in the stream, and I looked closer, and these were eggs that were being deposited in the stream by the caddisflies. So I waded back into the stream and washed them off, but this just looked like somebody spread Jell-O all over the front of your waders. That's how thick those eggs were. So yes, the nymphs do an excellent job on the smallmouth. And they'll take some of the larger bass, too, but, you know, something about big fish, big fly remains to be seen, too.
Yeah, yeah. I guess it just depends, like, again, the opportunity. You know, you got a lot of mayflies that say it's easy pickings and they're going to go after them.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, yeah. John Guthrie, talking, you had mentioned spring. John Guthrie in Kentucky wants to know, do you have any favorite patterns? He's talking specifically about the New River, but we can talk in general about fall patterns, like in October. Are there things that work better in the fall?
Fall patterns, I go back to when I was a kid growing up. That was back in the old days when people kept their fish. They had a contest going on at the Atlantic Service Station right beside my home in Edinburgh. And a lot of the local fishermen would go out and take a two-week vacation. They'd save their vacation all up until the fall and fish. This would be primarily on the Shenandoah, but the same thing works on the New and the James. These guys would go out and try to be the hero and catch the biggest fish for the bragging rights to all the way through till next year. And they'd bring them in, and they were actually weighed there and naturally killed, unfortunately. But anyway, most of those fellows were using the Mad Tom. that thing that looks like a baby catfish. So in the fall, when we're going big fish hunting, and my son is one of my main guides, and Jeff is always into the Mad Toms. We have one we call Murray Mad Tom Sculpin. And it does look a whole lot like a Mad Tom, and a lot of times in late in the fall, the guys that are big fish hunting, that's what they go for, and it works very effectively.
Okay. And let's see, Martin Coleman in Lawrence, Kansas. He asks, what are your top components for attractor flies when fishing for smallmouth? Example, color, reflection, water, distortion, etc.
He's going to be a little surprised at what I'm going to tell him. In the South, the old story was that any color popping bug was good as long as it was yellow. Well, I'm going to circumvent that and come back with blue. Don't ask me why, but the old Carolina blue popper that was developed by Bill Galosh here in Richmond, Virginia, about 40 to 50 years ago, is without a doubt head and shoulders over any popper we have. I have guides that buy them by the dozens. I have customers that buy them 30 and 40 and 50 at a time. But this Carolina blue popper, we call it, I've got an outfit out west building them for us. In fact, it's Umqua that's selling these for us. But it's called the Shenandoah Carolina blue popper. But the blue is the way we go on the top. And again, then when we go underwater, then we're really trying to match the natural foods.
Okay. So the colors on that were on the popper?
Blue. Carolina blue popper.
Okay. Well, you mentioned yellow in the first part.
That was the old story in the South, that any color was good as long as it was yellow. But, we still use some chartreuse. The deal up on the Potomac says if it's not chartreuse, it's no use. Yeah. But since Bill Galosh's blue popper came along, most people have left that and gone to the blue popper.
What is your, Lewis in Weston, Florida asks, what's your favorite hook size and type you prefer when tying bass flies?
4, 6, and 8. And that would be primarily on a 3X or 4X long shank hook.
Okay.
And if you're tying flies and don't have time to tie a whole lot, a 3X or 4X long shank size 6 cover a lot of smallmouth needs.
Now, what about Forrest in Idaho asks, what about weed guards? Do you use weed guards?
Well, when I grew up as a kid, one of my favorite writers was the old Jason Lucas of Field and Stream. He would croak, Sports Field. And he got in my brain with that statement he always threw out that said, weedless, fishless. Now, certainly weed guards do cause you to miss some fish, but we do put them on our poppers because the fellas down south that have heavy weed growth tell me they really do have to have a weed guard on there. I don't. In the drainages I'm fishing, weeds are not that much of a problem, so therefore I cut them off from my pattern. This same outfit, Umqua, that does my blue poppers for me, and all the damsels and all those poppers for me, I cut the weed guards off.
Okay.
Weedless
so, fish. Only if you need them is what you're saying.
Yeah, only if you need them when heavy grass.
Yeah. A couple questions, similar questions. Cactus Jack in Cheyenne, Wyoming. And interesting name. And Timothy Lindeberry in Connecticut both ask, they want to know that go-to fly when nothing else is working. What's your go-to fly both up on top and down below for this?
The Shenandoah blue popper is definitely going to be my topwater pattern. Underwater, it's going to be the Murray's Heavy Black Helgramite.
Okay. And that's because those are around all the time, you see.
They're there all the time, and, you know, they just seldom let us down. When we're doing our guide trips, when we're having our schools, the kid has never caught a smallmouth bass in his life. That's what we put on so he can get into some bass.
Good. Great. Well, we need to take another quick break here, Harry, and when we come back, we'll talk more about fly fishing streams for smallmouth bass. At Housatonic River Outfitters, we offer the finest in fly fishing products in Connecticut and fly fishing guides on the Housatonic, Farmington, and other waters. You have the option of wade fishing trips or drifting the river with our guides. In addition to the spectacular trout fishing, we offer guided fly fishing trips and spin fishing guide trips for warm water species. Please tour our website at www.dryflies.com. That's www.dryflies.com. to view the fishing products and guide services we offer in Connecticut and Massachusetts. We were the first fly shop in Connecticut to offer drift boat guide services, and we have the largest established guide service in New England. To learn more about Housatonic River Outfitters, visit www.dryflies.com. www.dryflies.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Harry Murray about fly fishing streams for smallmouth bass. If you'd like to ask Harry a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box there to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately. Try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Okay, got a couple more here, Harry, coming in on the Internet, dealing with flies, so let's try to hit a few of these. Wayne in Bella Vista, Arkansas, can you tell us about the strimp, where the idea came from and how to fish it?
The strimp was one of my concoctions probably 20 years ago. At the time, I was fishing almost every morning before I went to work. I don't have to get in the store until 8 or 9 in the morning, and I was hitting the river every morning. Well, some mornings I found the bass feeding heavily in the riffles, and I'd go with streamer-type patterns. And sometimes I'd find them feeding on nymphs and other parts of the stream. So then I'd have to go to the nymphs and experiment back and forth to streamers and nymphs to see what was working. Well, somewhere in there it dawned on me, if I could come up with one pattern that could pass for a nymph and a streamer, the word strimp, the streamer and the nymph, then I could simplify my hunting and pecking in the morning. So that's where I came up with that. Now, it took probably 2 or 3 years, and I kind of took the pattern off of Vince Marinaro. Vince was one of my heroes on the Spring Creeks up in Pennsylvania, and Vince would always cross patterns back and forth, and, oh, he has a very elaborate story for it in one of his books, but he'd take components of this pattern, cross them with the components of that pattern. Well, basically, that's what I had done, and what I ended up with was taking the tail off the Helgramite, the ostrich hair tail that proved itself, and use the body like Ed Shank uses on his white streamer. Now, we do this in black and olive and cream color, where we use nothing but a very sparse, maybe speckling and hen back for the collar, and then do a spinning loop, which is a little tough to tie until you get used to it. You can't just simply dub it on because you've got to trim it to shape. But use a rabbit for a body and then use ostrich hair on the tail, and doing that in those three colors, and we sell the daylights out of the strimp, and it's very effective all across the country. And you can fish it upstream dead drift, or you can fish it down and across as a streamer. So that's sort of the basics of the strimp, and it's still just as good as it was the day we developed it.
All right. Any other particulars about fishing that? You said, you know, down and across, but do you usually wait it?
You can fish it. The advantage of the ostrich harrow in there, Roger, is that the ostrich harrow, when you're fishing ostrich harrow upstream, unlike marabou, which if the current catches marabou, it kind of umbrellas down on top of the south. But ostrich harrow, the filaments are so much stronger. When you're casting this upstream dead drift, just as if you'd be a big fishing a big nymph on the Yellowstone River, all of that ostrich harrow sort of hangs together and wiggles as part of the fly itself. So it's very effective upstream dead drift, and then if you want to just turn down and across and fish like a streamer, you're coming home free with that one too. So it's a tough fly to beat, really.
Okay. We had a couple of people ask, and this may just cross over into your go-to flies, I don't know, maybe not, but Jim Mosier, and I've lost my screen on my computer here for the moment, but another person had asked about searching flies. Are your go-to flies your searching flies, or do you have other flies?
Well, I go to my match the hatch type stuff until it doesn't work. Now, I'm almost ashamed to say, about 3 nights ago, I was using my old favorite blue popper, but it wasn't working. And for some reason, I dug in my box and came out, we've got a series of poppers. I really hate that name because we do more than pop them. So I designed a series of flies I call sliders, which is just a pointed nose type popper, you might call it. And I went in there and dug out a great big orange thing, and I'll be doggone if that didn't do the job. So the go-to fly is just whatever seems to be working. One thing that no one has touched on, and the old-timers right here used to use for live bait, some sunfish. And my son and I were floating the river the other evening, and I caught a little sunfish. It was probably about 3 inches long, 4 inches long. And just as it was getting close to dark, so the big bass were brave, just as it was right, I was ready to pull it out of the water right beside the boat, a very, very large smallmouth bass came up and grabbed that sunfish. And it reminded me of the time that these old bait fishermen here in the valley were using sunfish for bait, because sunfish are there. There's a tremendous food for the bass. And I've got two different patterns in the line that we used to match these sunfish. In fact, after that one, my son Jeff said, "Dad, next year you're going to have to do a great big sunfish and put it on there just for these big bass," which we'll add that to the line next year. So that's something nobody has touched on, and sunfish are a very important food for smallmouth bass.
So I assume your patterns there are kind of a taller profile?
Yeah, well, yeah, you get into the, we just throw some yellows in there. There's nothing exotic, but you get kind of that yellows and orange and everything in there. I did them for, I think I wrote that up one time for American Angler. But they're on our website, or they can just call me on that. I'll be glad to help if they want to tie their own.
Sure, okay. The and are some of these patterns in your books, by the way?
Yes, many of these are in that, and I've written a separate book on fly tying that has, I think I've got 35 patterns or something like that. But many of these patterns are in that book that you described that we did with Frank Amata, that, what does he call it, Fly Tying Techniques for Smallmouth Bass. Many of these patterns are shown in there. And they're very effective, but it goes back to what we were talking about initially, trying to match what's the natural food that the fish are feeding on.
Yeah, yeah, right. Well, we've got a couple of questions here on equipment, and then let's talk about strategies and tactics, and we'll be good to go there. People want to know, weight, size, rod for smallmouth, anything you prefer there?
The standard rod for me is a 9-foot, 7-weight. I particularly like the one that the late Harry Wilson designed. That Harry was the founder of the Scott Rod Company and named the company after his son. Harry came up with a rod that he refers to as the 907B, meaning it's a 9-foot, 7-weight with a bass action. Now, it has a very, very strong tip relative to another rod you might use out on the Yellowstone. But the butt is sort of a medium action. Now, the justification, according to Harry on that, was that when we're fishing these big, we'll say, heavy flies like some of Bob Clouser's, like my Helgramites, like some of these sunfish we're talking about, they're heavy, they're bulky, they're down in the water, and you want to get those things up in the air. You don't want a wishy-washy tip on it. You want a strong tip on the rod. So when I come up with a rod, I want those things to get out of the air. Now, the other side of the coin is that they are bulky and wind-resistant. So once they're airborne, they're going to go through the air relatively slow no matter what I do to them. So by using the butt of the rod like Harry Wilson designed, that blends well with it. This spring I was on a kick of testing a whole lot of rods for bass fishing. And I thought, well, maybe I just don't have my arm in shape yet, or I thought maybe my line's getting more worn out than I want it to be. And I thought, before I give up on all that, I'm just going to grab that 907B. And it was the rod. It wasn't Murray. It wasn't the line. But that's what I like. I like a 9-foot, 7-weight with that bass action, with that strong tip and a slower butt. Now, on the big flies, now my magic number in there is 4. If I'm going to be fishing a lot of number 4 surface bugs, deer hair bugs, tapley bugs, I'll probably use the same thing. It's Harry Wilson's rod in the Scott line that handles number 8 line. But some of the 8s I use, oh, I don't like the word, but it brings the point home, is a broom handle. An 8-weight for bonefish is fine, but, you know, sometimes you can fish a long time and not make very many casts when you're fishing for bonefish. But when you're out here making hundreds and hundreds of casts a day, that real stiff 8-weight just isn't that much fun. So if I'm using real big flies, a lot of 4s, I'll say, then I'll use the 908B, but normally I like the 907B best of all.
Okay.
There is a trend now on some of the shorter rods, and I think there's a place for them. Not on my river. I want a 9-foot rod simply for drag control. What am I calling drag control? When I make that cast, the way I'm going to give that fly the action I need is to control the line between me and the fly. Well, if there's a fast current ripping through there, I may have to stick the rod tip way up in the air, mend and do all kind of, I might have to mend upstream, downstream, whatever, to do the job. Well, I feel I can do that best with a 9-foot rod. There's a trend now into some of the 8-foot rods, and there is certainly a place for them if you have limited overhead cover. If you, and I'm sitting right beside one of the streams that don't qualify on Big Stony Creek right here in Edinburgh. If Big Stony Creek's got too many limbs in the way and I'm crashing into tree limbs with a 9-foot rod, then there's a place for that 8-foot rod. You still, though, have to have an adequate line size to carry the fly you're casting. You can't go out there with an 8-foot 4-weight that you're going to use on a spring creek and expect to throw a number 4 popping bug. It just isn't going to work. So your line size has to be big enough to carry the fly size. So you could just put that in reverse. The fly size dictates the line size, then the line size dictates the rod size. The length of the rod is governed by the overhead canopy. So if people would look at it in that train, there wouldn't be so many people. The rods don't work.
Okay. Kurt in Woodland, California is asking, do you line your rod with, overline it with heavier weight line?
No, not if the manufacturer's got his head on right. If they've labeled for a 6, it should carry a 6. Now, there are some places, maybe like these real, real small streams that you can't get much line out. You may want to overline it there, but normally the manufacturers nowadays are very accurate in their rod design. And if they've labeled for a 7, it should carry a 7.
Okay. Let's see here. What about mainly fishing floating lines?
Floating lines, I use 3 different lines. I use a floating line this time of the year for everything because I've got low water and that type thing. This spring, we had high water levels well into June. So I was using a Sync Tip 3. I use I have to name the brand, Scientific Angler Mastery Sync Tip 3. And that, in that, about the first 10 to 15 feet sinks at about 2 to 4 inches per second. Of course, I tell the guys that's in the bathtub, not necessarily in the river. But anyway, I use a Sync Tip when I've got a moderate flow of water in the spring that I've got to punch through. And then also in the fall, which means mid-October on into November, I'll go to that Sync Tip 3 to punch down into that colder water. Now, in a high water situation, as I had this spring, and I probably had more water than I should have even been trying to fish, then I use a teeny 300, and that sinks probably, off the top of my head, I think it's about 6 inches per second. So those are the 3 lines I use, but the majority of it's going to be a floating, little bit of it a sink tip, and occasionally a teeny 200.
Okay. What about your leader and tippet setup?
9 foot 2X across the board. I discourage going much finer than 2X on most of these bass flies because if they're a little bit out of symmetry, they can twist your leader and you'll break off a big fish. Now, I especially like a compound knotted tapered leader better than I do the knotless and some of these others, but that's a matter of personal preference. But I like the one we call a bright butt leader. I put 5 feet of fluorescent amnesia up in the butt, stick a Scientific Angler indicator up in the butt section, one down, the second down, and I just put them on there and leave them on there. And I, for the school, the same thing. It's amazing. In the school, it's almost like pushing the replay button on your tape deck. The angler will be standing right beside you fishing streamers, and there are those little indicators, which don't interfere with the casting at all. It's just little tube things that Howard West put on the market for us years ago. I used to make them out of fly line, thread a needle through there, and then pull mono, and then finally we talked Howard into putting them in the market. But anyway, these guys will say, I just can't believe how much difference that makes. So I use a compound, tapered, knotted leader, 9 foot, 2X, almost across the board. Now, on the sinking lines, the sink tip, on the teeny and the sink tip, I still go to 2X, but I make those about 5 feet long.
Okay. Let's take a quick break, and then let's talk about strategies and getting those fish on the line. So when we come back, we'll talk more with Harry Murray about fly fishing for smallmouth. Women's Fly Fishing Alaska is owned and operated by well-known female guide Pudge Kleinkopf. Women's Fly Fishing offers several lodge-based fly fishing schools for women, as well as an array of small group-guided trips for women and couples to some of Alaska's best-known waters for salmon, rainbow trout, Arctic grayling, and char. Pudge also leads saltwater fly fishing groups to Mexico each spring. Beginners are welcome, and equipment is provided. Learn more about fly fishing for women at www.womensflyfishing.net. That's www.womensflyfishing.net. Or call them at 907-274-7113. That's 907-274-7113. Well, you're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Harry Murray about fly fishing streams for smallmouth bass. If you'd like to ask Harry a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Well, Harry, let's talk about strategies and so forth. We had, this is a comment and a question. Ed DeGangi in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania says, I had the pleasure of attending one of your son Jeff's mountain trout schools last year, and he did a great job of explaining where to look for fish. Can you do the same thing tonight and talk about how to break down a stream for the most likely places to find smallmouth?
That's an excellent question, and actually that's another one that's on my bass podcast. We actually drew, I had my artist actually draw the stream, and then I'm going step by step showing how to do it. And it's probably in both of my bass books. We start at the head of the stream and think about the food that's there, much like Jeff did in that trout school, talking about the food that's in the riffle. Primarily, these are going to be the helgramites, and then minnow-wise, it's going to be basically sculpins. So that's the way we're going to look at the head of a pool, using polarized glasses now, not to see the fish, but now to read the water. The most valuable thing in smallmouth fishing actually is reading the water. Now, to throw that back to the bottom line in a hurry, when you're getting on down into the middle of the pool or on down into the tail of the pool or fishing the grass beds, the whole secret of the thing is to look out there and say, where do I think the bass is going to be? Is he going to be beyond that riffle? Is he going to be below that ledge? Is he going to be beside that grass bed? All right, once you have answered that question, I think he's going to be beside that grass bed, then you've got to decide where to put your fly. Obviously, you want to put your fly beside the grass bed, or if it's a riffle, you want to run it through the riffle. So where's the bass? Where do I put the fly? Then here's the catcher. You've got to decide where to put yourself. You've got to get yourself into a position on the stream so you can wade that water effectively and fish the fly effectively and still not spook the fish. Same thing Jeff was talking about in the mountain trout stream. So get yourself into the right position and break it down into the riffle, the pool, the grass beds, a feeder stream coming in, a big log lying beside the bank, that a big bab. See, the sun, nobody's touched on that. That is extremely important, and that is the smallmouth just aren't wild about this bright sunlight. That's why I do most of my fishing in now from 5 o'clock until 8:30 in the evening. And the closer it gets to dark, almost better the fishing is. Now, if your time frame is better to hit it in the middle of the day, then go pound those shady banks. If you've got water knee-deep to hip-deep, chest-deep, along a shaded bank with oaks or sycamores back in there, you've got that depth over a cobblestone bottom. Now, muddy bottom, forget about it. But if you've got a cobblestone bottom, water waist deep, shaded bank, you should be able to take those bass all day long. So that is a very, very important part of the smallmouth game. But go try to fish the middle of the river in the middle of the day in the bright sun. Boy, if you get them, you're going to earn them.
So then if you don't have a choice and that's when you are fishing, so you're looking for shady spots under banks or along the side, try to get out of the sun as much as possible.
That's exactly right, Roger.
Yeah. Now, when you say you have these different places, for many of those listening that are trout fishermen, do you look in the same spots or do the smallmouth react differently? If they are holding out there, do they hold in the same spots and do they react differently than a trout would?
Tremendous amount of similarity. Every now and then I'll get a magazine editor that will want me to write a story teaching smallmouth fishermen how to fish for smallmouth bass. And I'll talk about however you were fishing those hoppers along the bank in the Yellowstone River is the same way you're going to fish hoppers on the bank in the Shenandoah River. And so there's a tremendous overlap in the feeding stations and feeding stations because there's a tremendous overlap in the natural foods and the way those, the trout and the bass feed. So if you grew up fishing Montana for trout and you moved into an area to retire that's got a lot of smallmouth in rivers now I'm talking about,
right.
Then you're going to be very much at home. Nymph, streamers, topwater. Now we're not going to go out there and match the hatch with a 14 or with a size 24 betas that we get them, but they don't seem to know what that is.
That's not even an hors d'oeuvre in their
No, not an hors d'oeuvre.
Okay. So they are looking for bigger stuff, you know, bigger food sources and so forth. And I guess that's maybe the difference is that they're going to come out and attack one of those larger type flies where a trout might turn its nose up.
That's right. But the streamer and nymph technique on smallmouth is quite similar to the streamer and nymph technique on the larger rivers like the Madison, Yellowstone, those type things. When I first developed the Murray's Helgramite, 30 years ago, I took some out to West Yellowstone, gave them to Charlie Brooks, and he just about went crazy about it for them, and he took them down to Ennis and gave them to a bunch of the guides down there to play with them, and they just had fantastic luck with them down there on the lower part of the Madison. So the nymph and the streamer technique is quite similar, trout and smallmouth. Topwater, a little bit more refined for trout.
Okay. How do you fish the Helgramite? Is there any special...
Upstream dead drift, just like you would if you were fishing over there upstream Carter's Bridge on the Yellowstone River, same thing you do out there fishing big stonefly nymphs. Or actually, that's another thing where I'm using the ostrich arrow. You can fish it down and across because that's really how I came up with the material that we put into the Murray's Helgramite. I wasn't satisfied with what I was using them. I was buying Helgramites on market. Now I'm talking about when I got out of college in the mid-60s. I was buying these so-called Helgramite patterns right and left. None of them worked, and I had Dan Bailey's girls tie some of the patterns out there that looked great, great big stonefly nymphs, and they just looked wonderful, but they just didn't catch bass. So having seen these Helgramites when I was a kid, I thought, well, let's see what happens. So I went into the riffles and started turning rocks over and pick up a real Helgramite and drop them in the water at various places around through the stream. And in each case, I found that these guys swam downstream with a very pronounced undulation-type action. They actually swam almost as well as a minnow. Rather than going down in a rigid surfboard-type structure, which all these other nymphs had been doing, I thought, good grief, no wonder they're not taking all these things. They don't act at all like Helgramites. So that's where I came up to using the ostrich arrow, which started with Ron Comer on musky streamers, of all things. He was a good friend of mine in Pennsylvania, and he sent me a bunch of it, and we started playing with it on Helgramites, and that came to be the answer. So that is very, very effective because it's it just mimics the action of the real Helgramite.
Now, it sounds like when you're talking about, you know, the approach there and some of the other approaches you've talked about, you had even mentioned polarized glasses not for seeing fish but for seeing structure and so forth. What do you not fish? Do you not sight fish for smallmouth? Is that normally not what
you're... Roger, that's a very good question. Usually by the time you're close enough to them to see them, you've spooked them.
Okay.
I wouldn't say if you see one out there, pass him up and say, well, it's too late, because there are times that you can see him. And I'm talking about lying underwater now. Topwater, you get to see that guy come up, you shoot it to him right away. But lying on the bottom, below a riffle, around ledges, that kind of thing, if you see him, give him a go, but more than likely, it's too late.
Okay, so you're primarily doing search casting,
right,
covering a lot of water. Back to a question I asked earlier. You know, I watch trout, and it's fun sometimes. You get up on a bridge, you look down in the river, and you can see them feeding straight down, so you can really watch their movement. And a lot of trout will just stay on that edge of that seam or whatever, and they'll just move out 2 or 3 inches, grab something, go back 2 or 3 inches out, back, and grab their food, and not moving very much at all. will the smallmouth in the same kind of situation move a lot farther for?
No. Do exactly what you just saw.
Okay.
When I'm teaching this with my classes, I stress that when my kids are fishing nymphs or streamers, I want them to fish where the fast water meets the slow water. To try to, because a lot of them don't quite understand what you were just talking about, but they can see where the riffle comes by and this boulder sticking out in front of it and there's slow water beside the boulder, so they can see where the fast water meets the slow water. Actually, that is the primary feeding station for many of these bass. They will lie not in dead water by any means, as I mentioned earlier, that's sunfish water, but they'll lie right along the edge of that fast water, and something runs by, they just reach out and grab it. So that really is a hot spot for both nymphs and streamers.
Okay, good, good. Bob in New Jersey, he says, I know trout like 50-degree water. Is there a certain water temperature that smallmouth really start to get active in?
Probably about 50, 55 degrees. Depends, and that sort of correlates in with water level. 55 degrees on my water level, on my streams, if I've got a decent water level, I'm doing pretty well. But if I'm carrying a lot of water, it may need a little bit warmer. Right now, the North Fork of the Shenandoah River is running at 76 degrees, and it's perfect for these smallmouth. Now, I have still had good smallmouth fishing in water running 80, 82 degrees. That's about as warm as it gets, but still in the evening, I've had good fishing, water fishing, in 80, 82 degrees.
Okay. Lynn Collins in Ohio wants to know, what do you find most productive, top water or underwater? What do you usually start to fish with?
Well, I like to fish topwater. That's where I came in with those three patterns I mentioned initially. Rather than call everything poppers, which I don't think I'll ever get everybody out of the habit of doing it because it's been with us too long, but I make the distinction between three different types of surface bugs, all of them hardhead foam. Now, all these I call them hardhead bugs. The slider is one I have with a pointed nose. Now, where I use that is against a shallow bank. When I say shallow, I mean water, maybe 2 to 3 feet deep, shaded bank back in there. I'll use that pointed nose thing where I want to entice sort of a teasing action into it, rather gentle, not loud popping by any means. But then I have one I call the chugger, which is a very fat cup face thing that you can just make all kind of racket with. Well, we'll fish that below a riffle to impart the action of a wounded or dying minnow. Casting it below a riffle where people never think about fishing a surface bug, but you come chugging across the water with that thing and water goes every which way, and I think they actually take it for a dying minnow. Then the popper, which we have more of a streamlined body but an upsloping face, then that's sort of a generic use it anywhere. But my preference is to go on the surface, and I almost always go on the surface unless I strike out, and then I'm going to go under with the Helgramite or Shanks White Stream or something like that.
Okay. Now, you just talked about two ways to fish poppers. Is there a right and wrong way then?
Yes.
Fish a popper?
Yeah, very much so. You want to gear the action to the depth of the water you're fishing. Like I was talking about on the, there's one place on the James River that we, there's some cobblestone banks tapering from water knee-deep out to water chin-deep. Well, smallmouth bass move along the edge there. They're not holding there. It's not on a feeding station like a brown trout would be, but they'll roam along those edges. Well, there's where we'll use that chugger with that big cup face and the fat body, and we just make a tremendous racket to pull him up out of that water that's 5 feet deep. But then we get along a shaded bank where the water's only 2 feet deep. If you use that same action with that chugger back against that, well, you'd scare that fish to death. So that's where we go to that little pointed nose slider type thing and just try to tease him into taking it. So you want to impart the action to your bug that's appropriate for the type of water you're in. There's no such thing as one action that'll do it all. It just doesn't work that way.
Well, that's interesting about the depth you said. That makes a lot of good sense there. A couple of questions, one from Bob Garman in Pennsylvania again, and Chris in North Carolina, are asking about muddy or cloudy water, maybe after rain or so forth. Do you bother fishing then, and if so, is there anything?
My magic number on that for my guide trips and for me personally
is if I can stand in the river in water knee-deep and see my feet, I think it's clear enough to fish. Now, if I'm standing there in water knee-deep and I think, I really can't see my fish. I mean, can't see my feet on the bottom of the stream. I'm 6 feet tall, so if I can't see my feet in water knee-deep, then that's probably too discolored for good fishing.
Okay. Question, what's the best time to fish a crawfish?
Late in the evening. My son Jeff and I were using kick boats one evening, and I got downstream to the takeout point about 15 minutes before he did, and rather than lug my boat up on the bank, I just sat there with my feet down in the water. I could not believe how many crayfish were coming out from under those cobblestones, running from one to the other, to the other, to the other. It just blew my mind. I probably saw over 100 crayfish scurrying around. I'm sure I saw some of them over and over. But they were scurrying around in this water knee deep where I was just sitting there waiting for Jeff to get down the river. And boy, if they're exposed like that, they're going to get eaten in a hurry.
Yeah, it reminds me when my kids were little and we'd go up to a place called Steamboat Lake, and after it got dark, we'd take a fishing pole with a piece of salami on it, and we'd go out there with a flashlight, and in the shallows, we'd just hang it in the water there, and the crayfish would come in and grab that salami, and then we'd lift them out of the water. The kids would have a ball doing that, but yeah, those crayfish were very active at after dark, and anyway, that just brings back an old good memory. Well, let's see here. I'm looking at some of our questions. Some of these we've addressed already. Do you change tactics for, well, this probably may not address you. Brian Ruscio in New York asks, do you change tactics for smallmouths entering streams from lakes versus resident smallmouths that live in streams year-round?
Well, Roger, I don't really have the lake-type situation.
Yeah.
I'm afraid I might mislead him.
Okay. Some of these are a little bit specific. There's another one about temperature here. And this person, Dick in the Chicago suburbs, talking about water temperatures remain about 70 degrees versus near 80 degrees. So the question is, how should I be fishing for river smallmouth bass in this cooler weather? From what you just told me, when you're up in the 70, that's not so cool anymore, is it, for smallmouth?
70 degrees is excellent water temperature for smallmouth. Now, what we have seen, Roger, if there's a drastic change, let's say the water in here in the summer, middle of August, let's say that water temperature has been running 80 degrees for the best part of a month, and all of a sudden you get 4 or 5 cold nights, and it drops down to, say, 72, 74. Now, although that water temperature is good for them to feed, a drastic change turns them off like crazy in many cases. It's almost as if they wonder if it's going to drop down to throw ice cubes at them. So a drastic change, and we see that especially in the spring when it's going the other way. We can have water temperature going 50, 55, 58, all the way up to, say, 60 degrees, and all of a sudden we're having fantastic fishing, and it drops back 2 or 3 degrees, and we can't catch near what we did at that temperature 2 weeks before that. Again, it's almost like it scares them to death, and they don't know how to react to it. So it's that drastic change that seems out of place that messes them up more than the temperature per se.
Okay, so a more gradual change shouldn't have any effect. But
doesn't seem to do it.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay. We have a specific question by Eric in Avondale, Pennsylvania. Are you familiar with the New River?
Somewhat. It's a little far away from me, but I fished it a little bit.
Yeah, he says there's sections there where there's a lot of angled stone plates that tilt upward and run diagonal to the flow, and he says it's kind of treacherous to wade, and it seems like every cast upstream with a clouser or a streamer, he's hanging up on the bottom. How do you fish those kinds of water where you've got a lot of rocks and so forth and avoid getting hung up?
Probably go down and across stream, or maybe if these are what I would call river crossing ledges. Now, we get a lot of that in the South Fork of the Shenandoah, where a ledge will go straight across the river, maybe completely underwater. Those places, just like he described, are awfully tough to fish. And maybe going down and across stream, or maybe straight across stream, or use slightly lighter fly might help.
But those are tough to handle any way you do it.
Okay, it's just going to be tough. Now, I don't know if sometimes we get friends submitting questions here, so I don't know if this is a lead-in to something I don't know about. But Jim in Crescent City, California asks, are there any adventures you want to share about with us about night fishing? Because you have been fishing at night. So I don't know if he's a friend of yours or not, or he knows something.
No, I don't know. No, because the story didn't get run. The magazine got in trouble financially. I had an editor. I got to tell you this. I'll tell you about how to fish it, but I got to tell you the first part first. The editor wanted me to write a story on fishing for smallmouth at night. I had taken some pictures of my son and I fishing at night. I thought, well, I really didn't get quite on. I set the tripod up and set the camera up and put the flash on it and get out in front of it and then push the timer and off it goes. And I thought, well, I better get just a little further away on the next couple shots. So up goes the camera and up with the flash, and there goes the self-timer, and here I am in the dark, stumbling out across the stream, upside down, the wrong part of my body sticking straight up in the air, and the flash goes off. The editor says, that's the cover picture we're going to put on the cover of the magazine. Now, how do you fish at night? One is go to a place that you're familiar with the area. You know what you're going to be encountering and waiting. You know where your back cast is going to be, not in trees and all that kind of stuff. Go to water you know, and definitely use a wading stick. I particularly like a Falstaff stick. So you've always got two points of contact when you're moving, and always go down and across stream. Down and across stream with streamers, or you can use topwater if you want to. If you get topwater, then you're going to hear them as well as feel them. But down and across stream with streamers, go real slowly, use a Falstaff stick, partly to punch along and make sure all of a sudden you're not going to step off the end of the world. But I especially like to go to an area that I know, so I know about my back cast, and definitely have a flashlight with you to plan where you're going to get out of the river, because some of the banks can be right dangerous getting out in the total darkness.
Yeah, I bet. I remember one time wading across a channel, and then it got dark, and then trying to get back across. Let's put it this way. I did a little floating downstream before I got my feet back on the ground. It was not comfortable. So I hear you loud and clear about making sure you know how to get out before it gets dark. I think that's real important. Well, we're out of time, Harry, and I want to end this with not really a question, but one of our listeners wrote in something, Lieutenant Colonel Bill Jones in Deer Lodge, Montana. So let me just read this. No question, just a testimonial. I was stationed in the D.C. area on temporary duty for a couple of months this summer. I came over to the Shenandoah to fish for trout. What I found was Harry's shop in a river full of smallmouth on the North Fork. I highly recommend his books. Following his advice put me on a lot of fish this summer. I had a great time. Thanks, Harry. So there you go, a little testimonial for you, Harry. Sounds like you do good work out there on the Shenandoah.
Well, Roger, that was very kind. We do have a good time, and I really, rather than me catch that fish, I'd rather put somebody else into it and see them get the joy of catching it. I don't know, that's just always the way I've always looked at fly fishing.
Okay.
And I just enjoy seeing people have a good time doing it.
That's a great approach. Great approach. Well, Harry, stick with me here for a few more minutes. We're going to wrap things up, but when we return, we're going to give away a 3-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a 1-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine and a copy of your book, Fly Fishing Techniques for Smallmouth Bass, courtesy of Amato Books. So stay tuned to see if you win. A mining company called Pac Rim Coal is planning a massive strip mine near Anchorage, Alaska. The Chewitna Coal Project would be the first project in Alaska history to mine directly through a salmon habitat. The Chewitna River drainage, 11 miles of it. And this is critical commercial, sport, and subsistence fishing economies there would be permanently destroyed. Pac Rim says it can rebuild salmon stream, but scientific experts can find no example where successful restoration has occurred after strip mining. The Chewitna coal would be shipped to Asia, leaving Alaska with nothing but devastated habitat and ruined salmon runs. It's time to stop the Chewitna coal strip mine now. So for more information, if you'd like to help with this, go to www.inletkeeper.org, that's I-N-L-E-T, keeper.org, or www.trustees.org, and you can find out more about the strip mining that could affect a fishery that you might enjoy in the future. Just a quick reminder to everyone, before you leave our website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. We'd like, you'll find a link on our homepage on the section under tonight's show that says, what did you think of the show? Just click on that and leave us your comments. And we'd sure appreciate it. Well, now it's time to give away our prizes. And the winners from our drawings are randomly selected from our database. So if you didn't register yet, then it's too late now. But make sure you get registered for the future drawings because we're always giving away some nice gifts. And so we're going to pick the winner for the 3-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers first. And if you want to find out more about the Federation, go to fedflyfishers.org. That's fedflyfishers.org, a great organization to support and be a member of. So let's see who our winner there is. And that would be Eric Seal. Eric Seal in Pennsylvania. And Eric, congratulations on that. If you've got a membership, you'll get a renewal for 3 years, and if you don't, we'll get it started for you. So I will email you and the next winner as well to get to collect the information we'll need to get you started on that. The next giveaway we're going to do is for Fly Fusion Magazine. Now, Fly Fusion Magazine is a magazine out of Calgary, Canada. Excellent how-tos in it, excellent photography, very well put together, and they are getting distribution on magazine stands throughout the U.S. now. So our winner there is J.T. Griffin. J.T. Griffin, and J.T. is in Virginia, so somewhere around you there, Harry. So congratulations, J.T., on winning that 1-year subscription to Fly Fusion. If you want to learn more about Fly Fusion, go to flyfusionmag.com, flyfusionmag.com. Okay, now we've got to ask a question, and let me just clear my board here, make sure nobody's answered the question before I ask it. And question for tonight is, what's the go-to insect that you would want to imitate for smallmouth bass? The go-to insect that you want to fish for smallmouth bass. So the first person that puts in the correct answer to that is going to win Harry Murray's book, Fly Fishing Techniques for Smallmouth Bass. And that's courtesy of Amato Books. And if you want to see more of Harry's books and other Amato books, go to AmatoBooks.com, AmatoBooks.com. So let's see, Harry, if we've got a winner. And, well, somebody gave us 2 answers. And I guess because he got the second part right, we'll give it to him here. He said Carolina Blue Popper or Harry's Helgemite as a dropper. So the dropper is the correct answer, the Helgemite. Correct, Harry?
That's exactly right, Roger.
So Jim Wright in Crescent City, California, you just got a copy of Harry's book, and we'll get that sent out to you. Please, Jim, send either the way you just sent the answer or to info@askaboutflyfishing.com. Please send your name, address, phone number, email address, and so forth so that we can contact you and get that book sent out to you. So, well, good. I'm glad we got a winner right away, Harry. And that Helgemite's got me intrigued now. I'm going to have to go play around with that and see how that works. Well, thank you so much for joining us tonight, taking time out of your busy schedule, because it does sound like you got a busy schedule out there, and we do appreciate you being with us tonight, Harry.
Well, Roger, this has been a tremendous amount of fun. I'm very impressed with the questions our folks have come up with. I can tell many of them are very serious anglers. So it's been a real pleasure. I've really enjoyed it.
Well, good, good. Maybe we can talk again sometime and enjoy the rest of your summer out there.
Thank you very much, Roger. It's a real pleasure to be with you.
Our next broadcast will be on September 2nd at 7 p.m. Mountain and 9 p.m. Eastern. And on that show, we will be interviewing Charlie Craven, and our topic for the show would be advanced fly tying techniques. Since so many of you wrote in saying you wanted to hear more from Charlie, we decided to invite him back. Charlie will answer all the advanced fly tying questions you can throw at him, so be sure to send in as many as possible before the show. We'd like to thank the Federation of Fly Fishers, Fly Fusion Magazine, Platte River Fly Shop, Housatonic River Outfitters, and Women's Fly Fishing Alaska for sponsoring our show tonight. If you think your company would benefit from sponsoring one of our shows, give us a call at 1-888-961-1115, extension 2. That's 888-961-1115, extension 2, and we'll be happy to explain the options to you. So don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.